What's the line from Gilbert and Sullivan? That culminating pleasure that we treasure without measure. That's you, George. Wait, don't go on. Hold on.
Oh, my God.
I just want to say very quickly that my friend George Marlowe offers an embarrassing example to people who make their livings as professors and writers, because he's written more books and instructed more people through his writings than many professors, even while he's made his living on Wall Street and now CEO of Philadelphia Trust, while commuting to his house back. Where's your home now?
I now live in Nassau County.
Nassau County. Of course, he's on the Control Commission. Now, he's been a contributing editor to the Catholic Thing, and he and I were part of the first band of brothers. Only a few of us are still hang on from the right.
And
he comes in every on time with his pieces. But George has been a remarkable career as a youngster, working in the Buckley campaign for mayor, running for the mayor of New York as the conservative candidate, serving as the head of the Port Authority under Pataki for two terms. He's done a number of books. A really good book on the American Catholic voters. There's the book on the Conservative Party. But he also did a guidebook for municipal bonds. And he's done some things, a little edited book on Fulton Sheen. But one of my favorites is some great work he's done in editing the works of G.K. Chesterton. Now, I don't know how he gets all of this stuff. He's just, he's a gift to the country. And a great American, as George Will would say. So welcome back, George Marlowe.
Thank you, Hadley. What are you going to do? The bane of my life, speak is okay, but we'll get used to that. It's good to be back here again. You may remember 4 years ago, I spoke in October, a month before the election, and I sort of laid out, building on what Noah spoke before me, that one as well, on a coalition how John McCain could win the election. He lost that election because he blew himself up for a host of reasons I'll get into in a minute, but there are certain fundamentals in terms of coalitions, and this election is going to decide which way this coalition is going, and I'll get into that as well. But I'm going to, since Noah touched on a few things I was going to talk about, I'm going to cut down my talk a bit on this. And I also want to address something that's been touched around here, particularly the federalism problem we talked about, the finances of the federal government that was talked about last night. I want to get into a crisis that is under the radar screen but is growing every day, the crisis of local municipalities. And we are going to see, because of a host of factors, from unfunded mandates to pension obligations to a host of things, that these municipalities are beginning to go bankrupt. I serve as a director of the Nassau Interim Finance Authority, which is a state agency that is the overseer of Nassau County, Long Island, which is the third largest, richest county in America that's going broke. Last year, we seized control of the county's finances. And I'll get a little bit into that and show the broader pictures of why Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is broke, just being taken over by the state. Detroit is broke, just taken over by the state of Michigan. They are looking at what's happening with us, with lawsuits and elsewhere. They're looking at the case law in New York concerning control boards, which go back to 1975 with New York City. So I'm going to truncate some things and jump around into this issue here, because I think there has to be more conversation on municipal fiscal crisis that is just jumping all over the nation. So I'll get into that as well. But in terms of this year's election, and the question is it the Republicans to lose? Yes, I think it is. The numbers have broken their way. Can Mitt Romney shoot himself in the head? Yes, he can. John McCain shot himself in the head 4 years ago. Bob Dole shot himself in his head in 1996. I think Romney will prove to be a much better candidate. I think he's a very decent guy. There's this biography that just came out called The Real Romney, written by Boston Globe guys, liberal guys. I read it last weekend because I figured it was time to read about the guy. And he's a very decent human being, a very generous human being. You know, everything he inherited from his father, Governor Romney the Elder, gave away because he didn't earn it. He has done more for people. He's lived the ethical foundations of the Mormon Church. And part of that ethical foundation is you don't talk about the things that you did. And so he's a generous guy and decent guy, but that dimension that's missing is because he's a mechanic. And at Bain Capital, when you look at his style on analyzing companies and saving companies, he is a mechanic. And he's missing that philosophical dimension, which entails also the vision thing, which George Bush Sr. failed at as well. Herbert Hoover failed at as well. Hoover, Bush, Carter, mechanics. And they failed in terms of turning to the nation and getting the nation on their side because the vision thing matters, as Ronald Reagan understood and Franklin Roosevelt certainly understood. They were probably two of the most administratively incompetent presidents in the history of this nation. But they were successful because it doesn't matter. You could hire good mechanics. There are guys meant in life to be number two guys. You give them the map. You say, I want you to get to here. I'll provide the mission. And they brilliantly get from point A to point B, even though they don't understand why they're going from point A to point B. They'll do it brilliantly. So that's what Mitt Romney has to come to grips with. He has to be comfortable with the fact that he's a multimillionaire. Nelson Rockefeller was governor of the state of New York 15 years. You're talking, you know, the robber barons, the name Rockefeller, what it generates. He was very comfortable in his skin. Okay, he was high a fella. He could campaign. I saw him campaign, eating blintzes, eating hot dogs off of hot dog stands on the corner. He was very comfortable with his wealth and say, yeah, I'm a rich guy. I'm not going to steal. You don't like it, that's tough. Michael Bloomberg, who has no personality whatsoever, is a short man who lies about his height, and he is like, I'm rich. You don't like it, that's tough. You know, the New York Times had a huge piece yesterday on his airplanes and helicopters. Like, he doesn't care. Yeah, I'm a rich guy. I take a plane. Don't tell us where you're going. It's not any business where I'm going. You don't like it, that's tough. So even a guy with no personality, when people want someone who they perceive as being competent, and he was competent in some levels and missing a certain dimension on another level, because Michael Bloomberg wanted to be loved by the Upper East Side of Manhattan at all times, and that's his world. And he knows nothing outside of that world. About in his first term, when he raised the cigarette tax, you know, we have the highest taxes on cigarettes in the nation in New York, in New York City in particular, where a pack of cigarettes is like 10 bucks on a candy store stand where you buy your paper. And so the Hispanics who own bodegas throughout the city, about 10,000 of them protested on City Hall complaining about the increase in this sales tax on cigarettes. And Mayor Bloomberg, being as dense as he is, dismissed them and said, I don't have time to waste time on something as trivial as a tax on cigarettes. What you understand is 80% of the sales in bodegas are cigarettes and lottery tickets. So that's a way of life for these people, very important for them. So that's the denseness. When you understand the shoveling of snow last year, similar problem John Lindsay had back in 1969, it determined the Republican primary back then. So these Upper East Side guys are very dense. But the fact is, he won, and he won three times. And so people look for a certain competence, and the personality matters sometimes don't matter. But against the great tap dancer, Obama, and Hadley, your theory on the debate is 100% wrong. That would be a disaster for Mr. Romney. He has to have control because he can't out-tap dance Obama. So he needs control. That controls possibilities. But he has to get, whether or not he succeeds in being comfortable in his own skin remains to be seen. But the fundamentals are there to win this election. And so when you look at, particularly going back since the days of FDR, you've had a series of coalitions that have come together. I really call the FDR coalition the Al Smith FDR coalition. Al Smith in 1928, running for president of the United States, lost. But for the previous elections going back to Grover Cleveland, even Woodrow Wilson, the Democrats never got more than 9 million votes nationally. Al Smith lost the election in 1928 but got 15 million votes. For the first time, immigrants, women in the inner cities were registering a vote. Immigrants were registering a vote. He was their guy. And this brought out a huge number. And for the first time in the history of the nation, the Democratic candidate for president carried a majority of the votes of the major cities in the United States, from Boston to New York to Chicago to Philadelphia out to L.A. That was a phenomenon. Franklin Roosevelt grasped this immediately. The weakness in Al Smith was he was a Catholic and he lost some of the southern states to Herbert Hoover. And that had to do just with religious bigotry. But Franklin Roosevelt grasped what was the makings there, that there was a shift taking place in the inner cities, which were basically Republican going back to the time of Lincoln. So we have the FDR-Smith coalition, inner city, blue Catholic voters, southern voters. And that was a coalition that came together in 32, actually lasted until 1952. But coalitions tend to fray the second they come together. I subscribe to this coalition theory as opposed to, say, Arthur Schlesinger and Walter Dean Burnham, who subscribe to alignments. I don't buy into the alignment theory. Michael Barone, who I'm a great admirer of, he wrote the introduction to my Catholic voter book. New young guys to watch, Sean Trend, just put out a terrific book on majorities. And Jake Cost is his name, Jake Cost, works at the Weekly Standard. They get a sense of how these coalitions work. I think their theory is a better theory. But functionally, the FDR coalition was dead in 1938 because what we saw then was Southern Democrats in the Senate, Midwestern Republicans like Robert Alfonso Taft of Ohio coming together to form a coalition in the Congress. That was developing into a national voting coalition. And we first saw it in the race of 1952 of Eisenhower versus Adlai Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson was the first Democrat nominated for president who frowned upon the values of their base voter, inner-city blue-collar workers. Eisenhower did two things in that election. He picked up a significant part of the Catholic vote, didn't carry it, but went from 20-something percent into the 40s and then picked up a series of southern states. That was the beginning of the end, the new Eisenhower coalition, the death of the FDR coalition. That coalition stuck together fundamentally till 1988, when George Bush was elected. And if you look at the period of time, there were only three Democratic victories during that period. One was the aberration of John Kennedy because of the Catholic voter factor. John Kennedy got 78% of the Catholic vote, but that was down from Al Smith, who got 86% of the Catholic vote. And what was happening then, if you look at parts of Westchester County, parts of Queens, parts of Staten Island, Irish Catholics who had jumped, thanks to the GI Bill of Rights, into middle class and upper middle class, didn't vote for John F. Kennedy, one of their own. And in 64, you look at the upper middle class Catholic neighborhoods, they voted for Barry Goldwater over LBJ. But you had the Goldwater debacle of 64 that sort of upset, slowed down this coalition. But in 1965, William F. Buckley Jr. runs for mayor of New York on the conservative line to stop John Lindsay, you know, Mr. Upper East Side, Mr. Yale. And Bill Buckley thought this was going to be a race between, he, Mr. Yale, and the dopey guy from Yale. And they thought this battle was going to be the Upper East Side. What Buckley didn't grasp was, I was on street corners from Brooklyn. We thought he was this, you know, Irish Catholic kid who did well. We didn't realize his first language was Spanish, his second language was French, and he was one of these la-di-da Catholic kids. But when you look at the demographic, blue-collar Catholic voters came out in droves to vote for William F. Buckley Jr. He got about 15% of the vote. And John Lindsay was elected with like 43% of the vote. But Richard Nixon, living in New York at the time, the firm of Nixon, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, and Alexander, on Lower Manhattan, 20 Broad Street, Nixon grasped this. And he was able to see what happened in the Eisenhower time was now really coming together. And in 68, if you look at the Wallace vote and Nixon vote, we saw the coalescence of urban Catholics voting for a Republican, Southern Democrats, you pick up some of the West, and this became Nixon Democrats and Reagan Democrats. And that was a coalition. But it began to fray. And Bill Clinton grasped one thing, that the only, and you had an aberration with Jimmy Carter, but Carter proved that some of the old Southern vote came back to him in 76. And then they repudiated him in 1980. Bill Clinton grasped that the only Democrats elected since FDR were basically Southerners. And we look at Harry Truman sort of as Southerner. His family was from the Protestant side of the state that was, you know, pro-South. And he understood that if you were in the center, you had to attract a certain suburbanite vote and you had to attract a certain blue-collar vote. He succeeded in doing that. But Ross Perot sort of broke things up a bit. In 96, when he beat Bob Dole, he only got 49% of the vote, but you could see the Clinton coalition. The Eisenhower coalition came to an end. You had the Clinton coalition. Gore ran to the left, and he still kept the remnants of that. Remember, he outpolled George Bush Jr. But it was fraying because he moved to the left, and a certain blue-collar vote was breaking away from Gore. And in 04, Kerry, who was the, you know, came across as the patrician, George Bush was able to sort of keep that, you know, to break up, nibble away at the Clinton coalition. In 2008, we saw the Clinton coalition again, but Obama did better than Clinton with inner-city liberals, suburbia, rich people. He didn't do as well with the blue-collar vote. And in 2010, the results last year, we really saw the collapse of the Clinton coalition. Now, Sarah, you're on. Sarah's going to put a... I only have 20 of these printed up. She's going to put four on every table, but if you could just take a look at this, and I'll go through my gibberish. It's handwritten. I had to do this the old-fashioned way, which was add numbers up, do basic arithmetic, which is computers don't know how to do, and to find this material.
I love it.
But the point I'm making today is when you look at these numbers, and you could share it, please, if you could, you're seeing a trend here where my argument is the Republicans can win if they do not shoot themselves in the head. And what I'm zeroing in on here, if you take a look at the sheet here, first fact to keep in mind, in 2008... In 2008, John McCain got 173 electoral votes. That's 97 shy of the prize. Now, that first column, those are my 12 swing states, which Noah sort of touched on. I think he would probably agree with most of these. Second column I have there is the Catholic population in those states, which I'll get to, because in the top six or seven states, that vote matters. Next column is the electoral votes. In 08, the next column, Obama, as you can see, carried all of those states. Yeah. Very tight in some of them.
North Carolina.
Yep. 49.8% of the vote. You look at the next column, that's what Kerry got in 2004. He only carried three of those states. And when you go down the column, in Michigan, he only got 51% of the vote, Kerry. You know, Michigan, we could say, is a home state for Romney. You go down to Pennsylvania. He only got 51% of the vote. These are genuine swing states that if you can get back to that sort of demographic, these states can be won. All of them can be won by a Republican. If you go to the next column, you see 2010, and an important number is what was the total congressional vote cast in those states in 2000? You take each congressional district. I had to add them up by hand. That's why you have this handwritten thing. Take a look at it. 2010, Florida, 59% of the total vote cast for all the congressmen went Republican. 58 in Indiana, 55 in Iowa, 50 in Michigan, 57 in Ohio, very important state, 53 in Pennsylvania, 55 in Wisconsin, the numbers go. The Republicans carried a majority of the total votes cast on the congressional level in each one of those states. That's a very important trend. Go to the next column. Those pluses are the number of congressional seats that were picked up by the Republicans, net increase in each of those states. Total is 27. That was about half of what they picked up nationally. You look at the next column, the governors, the R plus means that was a pickup for the governors. So the Republicans picked up net 11 governorships in 2010. Six of them come from those key swing states. If you go to the next column, the R plus is the U.S. senators. The Republicans picked up six U.S. senators in 2010. Three of them, half of them, came from those states. And if you look at the governor's column, you also have three other incumbent Republicans. So out of the 12 states, there's only three Democratic incumbent governors in those states. That tells you something about a trend that's moving Republican. So a center-right candidate has the opportunity to do extremely well in those states. Mitt Romney, if he plays it right, can carry the 97 electoral votes he needs to win, which means 61% of those electoral votes, or he has to carry about 8 or 9 of those states to win. Pennsylvania, key state, very much in play. Pennsylvania is known as Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and what they call the T in the middle, and some people refer to as Alabama, very conservative, socially, big guns. We have an office in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I run a company called the Philadelphia Trust Company. That part of the world closes the first day of deer hunting. Schools close. Everything closes. Everyone just appears. My office, like, nobody's in the office today. Well, don't you know? It's the first day of hunting. They just leave town. That's the mentality of the state. But what is interesting about that state, and this is where the Catholic voter comes into play. In Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. You have large Catholic populations. They are an older population, senior population. Young Catholics, cafeteria Catholics, sort of nominal Catholics. The young people went to school, moved away because there's no jobs in that part of the world. The people that are left are old Catholics, very socially conservative. And here's what happened in 2008. This is important. I did a big piece for the Philadelphia Bulletin on this right after the election. It's interesting, in Pennsylvania, the 10 wealthiest counties in Pennsylvania, Obama carried 7 out of the 10 of those counties. The turnout and vote went up on the average 5%. Rich suburbanites, upper middle class, voted for Obama in the suburban parts of Pennsylvania around Philadelphia. Interesting factoid. However, the 10 poorest counties, which is basically western Pennsylvania, Bush in 2004 carried 9 of those 10 counties, the poorest counties. McCain carried 9 of those 10 poorer counties. These are poor Catholics, economically depressed areas in western Pennsylvania. They are social conservatives, and that's how they vote, regardless of the economics. And what's interesting, though, is in 2008, although McCain carried 9 of those 10 poorest counties in Pennsylvania, the population of the voting population declined on average about 7%. There was a subset of those old-line Catholic voters who didn't like McCain for a host of reasons. I mean, McCain just, he never understood the social issues, and he couldn't talk about economic issues. It was just, everything was wrong. They didn't like him, but they wouldn't vote for McCain. They stayed home. Okay? They came out in 2010, and in Pennsylvania, they picked up 6 congressional seats, most of them in western Pennsylvania, Republicans. They picked up the governor's seat. They picked up a U.S. senator in Toomey, a real conservative Republican, and they maintained the state House of Representatives and picked up the state Senate, trending Republican seriously. So here you have poor Catholics voting Republican. And if they come out for Mitt Romney and the numbers they came out for George Bush in 2004, Pennsylvania can be carried. One other interesting fact about the great Obama. There was this impression that the turnouts were coming out leaps and bounds, and in Philadelphia they said he was going to carry the world in Philadelphia because it's 48% black, and he's loved there, and he spent more time there, and Rendell was with him. Here's an interesting fact. Kerry got 81% of the vote in Philadelphia in 2004. Obama got 83% of the vote in Philadelphia in 2008. But what is interesting, the voting population was down 10% for Obama. That's a huge number, because everyone assumed they were coming out, you know, banging down the doors. Who stayed home? South Philly. Blue-collar, Democratic, Union, Italian. They stayed home. They didn't like McCain, but they weren't voting for Obama. So even the great wonder in Philadelphia didn't all do that well compared to the average. He was basically average what Democrats get in the city of Philadelphia. So his coalition was fraying the day people voted, because the Clinton coalition was dying under Obama, except he did well with the suburbanites and the kids came out in full force. The question you asked about the kids is enthusiasts. By their definition, enthusiasm is short-lived. You know that in Ronald Knox's book on enthusiasm. These kids want instant gratification. They haven't gotten it. And their numbers were down dramatically in the 2010 elections. They will probably be down again. So the young kids who matter probably aren't going to come out. Who matters? People over the age of 50 matter. They came out in droves in 2010. So the working coalition there to elect Mitt Romney president of the United States is his for the taking. Okay? And it could be a new coalition because the Clinton coalition is dying. And the Democratic Party has moved that much further to the left, and there's only so many electoral votes. And even the Hispanic vote. Let's talk about that for 1 second. Interesting numbers to consider. If you read Michael Barone's book called The New Americans, which is a worthy book, came out about 6-7 years ago, his analysis of the Hispanic vote in the United States, he compares them to the Italians who came over from Europe between 1880 and 1920, very much like them. They live in the neighborhoods. They revitalize neighborhoods, which they're doing in parts of Brooklyn and elsewhere. They work the neighborhoods. They open up small shops. They work 20 hours a day. First generation starts the business. Second generation continues the business. Generally, a third generation starts to go to college and things along those lines. Very much like the Italians, who were in South Philly to this day and parts of Brooklyn to this day, parts of Staten Island to this day. That's how the Hispanic, the Hispanic mentality is. Very different from the black mentality. Barone compares the Irish and the blacks together. They soak the government for everything it's worth, and my own people did that when they came over running City of New York back in their day, and now the African Americans think it's their turn to run the New York City. That's how it sort of works. Hispanics are very different. Hispanics are also growing at leaps and bounds. Hispanics are also socially conservative. And what is interesting, as the Hispanic goes up the economic ladder, he votes Republican. I'll give you some ideas. Latinos over 100,000 voted 44% Republican for McCain in 2008. Latinos under 15,000 voted 29% Republican. And what is interesting, when you look at some of the shared votes Republican-wise, Arizona, we all think of this ugliness out in Arizona, 43% of the Latinos voted Republican in 04 for president, 41% for president in 08. Okay? They didn't like the governor. It went down to 28%. What's her name? Brewer out there?
Brewer.
They didn't like her. But the Senate candidate, who was 2010? Who was?
McCain.
Yeah. They voted 40% for McCain. Even in California, your home state, 32% of the Hispanics voted for Republican for president in 04. It went down to 23 in 08. Jumped up to 31% in your governor's race last year. Okay. So there's a trend line. It's not the end of the world. So the more money they make, go up the economic ladder, like the Italians, like the Irish of yesteryear, they're voting into the Republican column there. So there is tremendous hope here. And when you look at those numbers on that sheet there that I laid out, that's the roadmap to the election. And keeping in mind what happened in Pennsylvania, poor Catholic counties vote Republican, same thing in Ohio. They are socially conservative, north of 50 Catholics, who are O-line, what we call pre-Vatican II Catholics. Hadley, you would know about that, but there's such thing as pre-Vatican II Catholics. And there's guys like you that came later in life. But anyway, so all these issues matter, where the Electoral College, that 157 electoral votes, all he has to get is 97 of those. So there's room for error here. So at the end of the day, it's good news. The trends are going that way. If the Republicans don't shoot themselves in the head, which they are capable of doing, the election could be won. So that's those issues there. So I'll be happy to entertain questions at the end on that. But you want to get a sense of how these things have gone back and forth, I recommend reading my American Catholic Voter book that came out a few years ago. But let's talk about for a minute now the crisis of municipalities throughout the United States. And this is very important. You may remember in 1975, the city of New York went broke. Okay. What happened was fundamentally this. The John Lindsay years of government will solve all the problems, the Great Society mentality, which John Lindsay took to the nth degree. By 1975, the New York City budget was at $12 billion. Today it's at $60-some-odd billion. That $12 billion budget, 40% of it was of the operating cost of the city, of that $12 billion, was paid by short-term debt, one-year notes. So every year, the city of New York was spending more, but not taking more income. They did short-term borrowing. There were a host of fiscal abuses that they were allowed to do. New York State, thanks to Robert Moses, Nelson Rockefeller, and a brilliant bond attorney by the name of John Mitchell, who was later of Watergate fame, they came up with every financial gimmick that this nation has emulated for the last 50 years. Okay? New York started it. Everybody else copied it. I ran the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which was the first bi-state agency in the United States. The compact had to be passed by the state legislature of New York, New Jersey and New York, signed by the governors, and then that compact was approved by the Congress of the United States and signed into law by the President of the United States. It was the first bi-state agency. And what was the purpose of that agency? It was a way to issue debt to get around constitutional limitations of the state of New York and the state of New Jersey. The objective was to originally to handle the ports, which was on both sides of the river, and to build a tunnel underneath to have freight trains go through. We're still waiting for that tunnel. Over time, New York City wanted to get rid of their airports because the fledgling airports in the 40s, and they didn't have the money to build these airports, so let's give it to the Port Authority. Port Authority is, when I took over the Port Authority, we were managing the three airports in the region. We owned the World Trade Center. I was the manager of the Trade Center. My office was there. We had the ports. We had the PATH subway system, which Jersey dumped on New York, on the Port Authority because it was the old bankrupt Trans-Hudson rail system in exchange for Nelson Rockefeller getting the money from the Port Authority to build the World Trade Center because David Rockefeller built the national international headquarters at Chase in Lower Manhattan. And Lower Manhattan in the early 60s was one beat-up dump. So he said to his brother, we've got to do something to revitalize this area. So we built the World Trade Center, which was 11 million feet of commercial real estate, the trade centers, the towers, which is more real estate than there was in Dallas a couple of years ago, just in that 11 acres in downtown Manhattan. But the purpose gave Nelson Rockefeller, who cloned this into 200 other state agencies in the state of New York, the ability to get around the constitutional limitations of issuing debt and doing what he perceived as great things. Because under the New York State Constitution, if you want to issue general obligation debt, you have to go to the voters. And every time Nelson went, they voted it down, so he said, I'll show you. So he created this array of agencies, the pinnacle one being the Urban Development Corporation. To make a long story short, Hugh Carey is elected governor of the state of New York in 1974. He takes over the Urban Development Corporation, is collapsing the city of New York. His famous were two things. Nelson Rockefeller said, oh, poor Huey, it's no fun being governor unless you have the money, and I've spent all the money. And Huey Carey said, when he looked at the books of the state of New York, he said, I've seen delicatessens in bankruptcy in better shape than the state of New York. So the city of New York issuing all the short-term debt to fund an operating budget. The capital project dollars, the city of New York was stealing from the capital project funds, long-term debt, 30-year bonds, which you used to do, fix bridges and roads and subways. They basically stole that money and used it for operating purposes. Albany sort of blessed all of this. Albany let them have what they called budget anticipation notes, which gave them the ability to just make up a number on the budget and say we could fund it with budget notes. They blessed it up in Albany because you have tax anticipation notes, revenue anticipation notes, budget anticipation notes, which is made up numbers. It reached a point where Wall Street could not underwrite the short-term debt anymore. It just snowballed. Every year it got bigger to the point it reached $12 billion budget. It reached about $5 billion of rollover debt. At the time, that was a lot of money. They had no place to go with this. Portfolios are full of it. People were full of it. You couldn't go anywhere. The markets closed the door. The city could not operate. To fix this, the genius of Hugh Carey, and I happen to think he's one of the great governors of the state of New York, and I had the privilege of knowing him, was at his Requiem Mass at St. Patrick's last fall. He came up with two things. The Emergency Financial Control Board, which basically was the overseer of the city and had the power to tell him what to do. Then they had to issue debt to take care of the short-term debt, so they created the Municipal Assistance Corporation Bond. Whereas they took all the short-term debt, there was a technical default by an act of the state legislature. The state legislature approved it, saying the notes are up. In return, we're giving you a 30-year bond. And it was like, huh? Now, the bond was structured to get the revenues of the sales tax. So what happened is, state now collects the city sales tax, which is huge. They deposit it with MAC. MAC takes out principal and interest payments, and what's ever left, the city gets for operating purposes. This gave MAC bonds AAA status, while the city was subgrade B, triple B minus back in those days. It went through the courts. They lost one court battle on this, and they had to restructure all the stuff. But at the end of the day, the MAC box bonds, in retrospect, were good as gold. I happened to be running the Marine Midland Bank's municipal bond portfolio at the time, and part of the clearinghouse bank deal was we just had eight MAC bonds. The banks agreed, just there was no underwriting, you just took them. Back in 1980, there were MAC bonds with 11% coupons on them. All right? That's triple tax-free, no state tax, no city tax, 11%. Okay, right now, a 30-year bond is at 2.5%, 2.75% tax-exempt bond. So in retrospect, if you had money and you were smart, their outstanding bonds. But the point is, the state had no alternative but to fund out an accumulated operating deficit of the city of New York and fund it out. In return, the city had to balance their budget within 4 years under GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, which no municipality in the nation has done, and there's only a few of them have ever done that. Generally, it's not cash accounting, where they could just play the little games at year end and say it's pretend it's balanced by short-term debt or other things. Ed Koch, as mayor, when he became mayor, said, what do I have to do to get rid of you guys? And they said, here's what you got to do. He bit the bullet. Police department was cut by 15%. Teachers were cut by 19%. Sanitation department was cut by 25%. They cut out hundreds of thousands of jobs. Really, capital projects came to a halt. There was no money. The city started falling apart. That was the negative side. But the point is, Ed Koch was willing to govern and clean up the act. And since that time, they have been under GAAP accounting principles. It's most transparent. You may not like the way they spend the money, which is fair, but they run a city transparently under GAAP accounting principles. It's for real. Nowadays, we are seeing municipalities beginning to collapse all over again. Nassau County, New York, third richest county in the United States in 2000 because of overspending, refusing to raise taxes, giving away union contracts, and pension contributions, which are beginning to grow leaps and bounds, and I'll get back to that in a minute. Got into deep trouble. The state bailed them out. Home rule message asked for a creation of a control board that was granted by Albany. They gave them the power to NYFA to issue bonds like MAC bonds to basically fund out their accumulated deficit. To give you an idea, in Nassau County in the last 10 years, they have issued $2.7 billion of debt, of which only 40% of it was for capital projects. The rest was basically to fund out all this accumulated deficit. But Nassau County, once again, is back in the drink because they learned nothing from this. I was appointed to this control board 2 years ago. We seized control of the county last year. The county executive is a Republican conservative who I helped elect. He doesn't like me anymore. And I also discovered he's a dope. But putting that aside, I expected corruption. I expected a lot of things. But I realized a lot of these local government guys, and you talk about grassroots tyranny, I think Clint Boltic wrote a book on that some years ago. He has it right. What he didn't get was most of these guys are dumb in local government. They're not very smart. We drive them crazy on this control board because we're seven independent guys. Most of these guys are pretty well-to-do, pretty smart. But what is happening to municipalities is that, A, like Nassau County, the present county executive was a county legislator, gave away the most outrageous union contracts on the face of the earth. Arbitration is a farce. In New York State now, all these municipal unions, they can't come to a deal with the governing entity. They go into arbitration. Here's how arbitration works. The unions pick an arbitrator. The county picks an arbitrator, or the city, or the town. Then they have to agree on a third arbitrator. The unions say to the guy, by the way, if you don't go our way, we're never going to side with them on you again. These arbitrators make a lot of money. They can make $1 million a year. It's all rigged. The elected officials can say, not my fault. The arbitrators gave us this contract. The union guys know the whole thing's wired. This is the farce that's been going on in the state of New York, reaching a point where you have contracts. I'm the son and grandson of New York City cops. All right, I like cops. Nassau County cops. Average patrolman is making north of $100,000 a year. He becomes a cop at 20, retires at 40, gets half pay with overtime and all the perks that are in this pension. He's walking away at 40 years old with a pension of $100,000 a year, can retire, 100 big ones a year, no state tax on that, no Social Security. If you live in the city of New York, no city tax. Think of that in terms of an annuity. If you were getting an annuity of $100,000 a year at age 40, what would that pot of money have to be, assuming you're going to live to 80? This is what's happening all through the state of New York. The average public servant makes $65,000 a year in New York. The average private sector makes $45,000 a year. You cannot sustain the system. But on top of that, this pension system, and New York State's pension system, which is about $150 billion in better shape than California, but it's not that far behind. These pensions were set up with the assumption that you were a Ralph Cramden bus driver. Okay, remember Jackie Gleason show. you gave up income for some security, and you got a modest pension at the end. My grandfather became a cop at the end of the First World War when he got out of the Army, retired in 45. He was 45 and was dead at 55. Yeah. The assumption was you weren't going to live very long, and that basically worked. Now you have people retiring at 40, you know, not at a modest pension, but at 100 grand a year. You have superintendents of schools on Long Island retiring at 300,000 a year pension. So the day of reckoning has arrived where the contributions to pensions are jumping by leaps and bounds. The average municipality in the state of New York, and there are 8,000, be it a school district, town, a village, a county, city of New York, etc. About 8% of their budget was pension contributions. Because they got their clocks cleaned in the market in 08, because interest rates are so low and, you know, you're assuming a fixed income, they have to assume 8% a year return. They're not getting 8% return a year. Worse than that, I think there's going to be a greater day of reckoning because many of these big pension systems now got involved more in hedge funds, more in special alternative investments because they're looking to grope, they're groping for returns. As a result, municipalities' contributions over the next 3 years will grow to over 20% of their budget. It's just growing like this. So in addition to these contracts where step pay and everything else goes up dramatically, you've got increased revenues for that. Your pension contribution is jumping leaps and bounds. You've got increased revenues for that. New York State and local taxes are the highest in the nation. Property taxes, particularly on Long Island, are going through the roof. I own a little lot of land, 60 by 100 lot with a house on it. I'm paying $13,000 a year taxes on that, on this little lot, 60 by 100. And it's just out of bounds, but it's all catching up. The pension system cannot sustain itself. Under the New York State Constitution, any benefit you get in collective bargaining and a pension can never be taken away. So now we have a new Tier 6 budget. Cuomo lost the guts to fight for the 401k. He was mouthing it off and surrendered. But that's for the unborn, and even the new Tier 6 is no great deal, but it's for the unborn. People haven't been hired yet. So it doesn't solve the problem of people, the baby boomers, who are now collecting these huge annuities that can go on for 20, 30, 40 years. So the pressure is on municipalities. They're running out of revenue streams. You have unfunded mandates like Medicaid. In New York State, the local municipality pays 25 cents on a dollar. You have the pension price funds going up, contributions going up. You have union contracts that are outrageous. And you pushed taxes to the wall. Municipalities are beginning to explode. I'm being sued right now as a NYFA member by all the unions. The county sued us. We won that suit. Rockland County, New York, just raised property taxes by 30%. They're about to go broke. There are 12 counties in upstate New York, smaller counties, poorer counties, that are going broke. Municipal crisis is real. Harrisburg or Pennsylvania, Michigan are watching all these lawsuits we're involved in because they're going to start creating control boards. But the question is, where does it end? Well, you got Stockton, California, went broke. You got Jefferson County down in one of the Carolinas that just declared. It's a different kind of Chapter 11 municipalities. They're running out of money. The property tax bases have been taxed to the hilt. Unions don't want to give up anything. They'd rather see people get laid off than give up something, because if they get laid off, they can't vote against the union leaders in the next election. If you give something up, they'll say, I lost that. I'm going to vote you out of office. What do you think of that, union leader? We have the power as a control board for a wage freeze. We do it annually. We just did the second wage freeze. There were people booing us. I thought we were going to get, there was going to be a riot. Because that's the one power we have over contracts. We as a oversight agency can impose a wage freeze, which we did. So all those steps and all those other things come to an end. But in New York State, you have something also called the Triborough Law. So a contract runs out with the teachers. The Triborough Law presupposes that even with no contract, the steps you had, you know, you get your increases, $5,000, continues when you have no contract. And when you finally get a contract, you're not over here where you were when the contract ended. You could be up here now. So it's all rigged. And municipalities are running out of money. And there's going to be tremendous defaults. It just can't sustain itself anymore. So no one is looking at this issue that you touched on. We know the issues on the federal level. No one wants to talk about this. And just as was pointed out earlier today where, you know, New York is giving a lot of money to Wyoming, downstate is giving a lot of money to upstate. All these great Republican conservatives who swear to the principles of fiscal conservatism in upstate New York, they'll vote for any tax increase on statewide because they know there's nobody left in their areas that have money. It's all people downstate. So you have the same phenomenon in New York, and it's similar in Pennsylvania, it's similar in Ohio, it's similar in Massachusetts, and all this is catching up. The day of reckoning has arrived. So this is an issue where there has not been enough talk, not enough thought, and Wisconsin is important to the unions in New York and everywhere because if he imposes his will, legally, to start taking things back from the unions, that might spread across the country. So this is really a war to the death in Wisconsin because if he survives in June, that will be a message to the nation that these are things you could approach. So the union money that has to be flowing, they'll be taking busloads of people from unions all over the state, all over the nation, to try to recall this guy and put the fear of God in all politicians. And if they succeed, again, the day of reckoning is right around the corner. So we are facing a municipal crisis in this nation where they're going broke. And I don't know how to fix it, okay? We're doing what we can in Nassau County, but the flaw, I should say the assumption in control boards was that the elected officials want to govern. Ed Koch wanted to be mayor and get rid of these overseers. He did what he had to do. He says, I want to be mayor. And I've had these conversations with Koch because I'm 89 years old. He still has all his marbles. Our county executive, although he fought us when we took over because he was embarrassed by all this, he wants us to hang around because he doesn't want to make the decisions that have to be made to clean up the county. He wants to be able to say, it's not my fault, it's them. They forced these cuts, and they put this job freeze, and they put this wage freeze. So the presupposition of control boards is the elected officials want to get rid of you as soon as possible, and just the threat of a takeover will get an elected official on the straight and narrows. I said that to Governor Cuomo at St. Patrick's Cathedral a few weeks ago for Cardinal Dolan. He came up to me on this and said something, and I had 2 minutes to say, here's my shtick. It assumes people want to govern. They don't wish to govern. So I'm an unelected official imposing my will on a municipality and its elected officials because the elected officials don't wish to govern. They want to be victims. So the gutless wonders we're dealing with add to this problem. The county executive, as the county legislature, he complained to me. He said, well, you know, I inherited this police contract. It's an outrageous contract. It's 400 pages long. The New York City contract with their police is 28 pages long. This is 400 pages long. The unions control the police force, not the police commissioner in Nassau County. And he said, I inherited this contract. I said, as the county legislator, you voted for the contract. He said, well, my predecessor said there'll be tax money for it. He said, yeah. I said, that was that home heating fuel tax you repealed when you became county executive. They want their cake and eat it. Being a legislator is so easy because you're not responsible for what you vote for. Let's go play golf with the union guys. They all love me. Yeah, I'll vote for your contract. Sure, I'll vote for your contract. I don't know what it means, but I'll vote for your contract. Ed Koch, as you may recall, called himself Mayor Cooper through my fault. He said, when I was a member of Congress for 14 years, I voted for legislation, great society legislation. I thought it was the greatest stuff on the face of the earth. Now that I'm a mayor, I realize I was a real jerk. This stuff is impossible to execute. Okay? Call me Mayor Cooper through my fault. I'm responsible for this crap here. And he caught it. He got it. There are no Ed Koshes anymore. There are no men who wish to be strong and lead and cut through the nonsense and do what has to be done. They all want to be victims. So the system is failing. The local government, which we subscribe to, the concept of subsidiarity and a host of other things, is failing. It's either the grassroots tyranny of a regulatory, the nanny state that Michael Bloomberg is trying to enforce upon us. Now, the world is falling apart, and he's worried about salt. At one of his press conferences here recently, salt and asbestos, they're both bad for you. Right? This is what he's worried about all day long, salt. Right? The nanny state on the one hand is this tyranny, yet on the other hand, the elected officials are becoming victims. They are basically a subsidiary of the public servant unions in all the major cities in this nation. And so Wisconsin is very important for precisely that reason. Do we begin to break the backs of this control they have over county legislatures, state legislatures? In Albany, they rule the day. Andrew Cuomo, I've known him since he's 17. We don't see eye to eye on a lot of things. I'm sort of the token, because he and Mario would always talk to me. And Mario and I cross swords a lot of times. He sort of gets it. But even he had a first good year. But this year, he surrendered on a host of things. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they just don't go away. And now the average voter, he has to worry about making his mortgage payment, going to work, educating his kids. These unions never go away. And they basically control all of it. And they control Springfield, I'm sure, and Trenton and a host of other places. So the end is near. So there is time to have conversation, analysis on the crisis of municipal governments, which nobody's talking about. So I leave you with a very unhappy message. It is bad. It is getting worse. And if we don't draw attention to it soon, we are going to see scores of municipalities go bankrupt across the nation. Governments come to a halt because the money's just going to run out. So with that depressing note, I thank you for having me. Hadley, thank you so much.
Assuming the worst case scenario in Wisconsin, and this problem isn't addressed, ultimately, are the bankruptcy alternatives for municipal government such that they'll eventually can renegotiate these pensions? Because, I mean, once a pension's given, I mean, it's there.
There is case law. I gave a paper. I'm not a lawyer by background, but I gave a paper. But I grew up in the municipal finance. The first 15 years I was in securities business, I was in the field of municipal finance. I gave a paper at St. John's Law School on control boards, their powers, and I had to sit through and go through all the case law. And there's a lot of it in New York. You had the city of New York, then you had the city of Yonkers went broke. They had a control board. Buffalo has a control board. Erie County has a control board. I think Utica has a control board. And the union sued everywhere and wound up in federal courts and all over the place. State legislators can abrogate a union contract in emergency periods or permit a municipality to abrogate a union. This has been held up in federal courts. So there's a lot of case law out there that everyone's studying very carefully. So yes, if you get to that. But you got to get the will of the state legislature to do that. Suffolk County, Long Island, a new guy took over, happened to be a Democrat. He called me. I was out to see him 2 weeks ago just to give him a note because he realized Suffolk County now is in deep trouble. He's inherited, you know, he looked in the bottom drawer and said, oh, my God, what the guy left, my predecessor left me. The unions now will fight the creation of control boards. They don't want control boards anymore because they lose out. And so they will lean on the state legislature. No, it's got to be a better way. Well, what way? Yeah. So kick the can down the road, and it'll blow up later down the road. So case law supports the abrogation of contracts. You have to have the will of the state legislature to create the control board, give it its proper power. This has evolved over time. The one in 75 was pretty good, but, you know, they did this in the middle of the night, created this thing. If you read legislation, our NYFA legislation is flawed. We have to judge the county on a gap basis. But they run on a cash basis. So each of this legislation has a little flaw in it. Each of them has been tested in the courts. You got to write better legislation. Legislation, I don't sit around and read legislation all day long. Legislative writing is the most important part. You look at these statutes and you compare them and you see a comma missing here, a phrase missing here. All this matters. So you got to do it right and you have to have the will of the legislature. Watching what's happening in Nassau County, particularly with the wage freeze, unions are going to say, we don't want this. There's got to be a better way. Well, there is no. It reaches a point where there's no way. Because what happens at the end of the day is if your rating is dropped to a point where you're go below triple B, tax-exempt mutual funds, banks, investors, investments in bank portfolios, no institutional buyer could buy a subprime piece of paper, a note or a bond that's below triple B. So what will happen is the municipality, all right, the capital projects then will have to close down, but the seasonal borrowing, tax anticipation notes, revenue anticipation notes, which are used for cash flow purposes and are legitimate, that will come to a halt, and municipalities will come to a halt. So that's the day of reckoning when they can't underwrite short-term debt for cash flow purposes. We cut a deal at Nassau County in December, of which if they don't keep up their part of the deal very shortly, we're going to have another crisis. We avoided a close down of the county in December by cutting an overall deal and giving them approval, because we as a control board have to approve every bond issue that is proposed and passed by the, even passed by the county legislature. We can close them down in 5 minutes. We didn't think it was prudent to close down the county on Christmas Eve. That's what, you know, they timed this all for December 24th. Well, you're going to close the county on, no one's going to get paid on Christmas Eve. Boy, you guys, I said, you know, we're going to have a million people. And my wife is like, are we going to have like 50,000 people protesting on our house on Christmas Day? I said, we might. Okay, and they'll be, I'm starving, you're eating that prime rib in your house, and we're, my children are starving. Now, yeah, just imagine the theater of the unions. But the point is, the day comes when you can't raise money and make payments. Bankruptcy and reorganization, all those stuff out there, is really not, it's been tested for, you know, tax-exempt hospitals that have gone broke and special purpose, you know, phony baloneys that were put together and broke. But in terms of a real municipality, there's the, if you go back and look in the New York Times and the old bond buy back in the 70s, well, if the city defaults, can you tag police cars and just, you know, drive off in a police car and repay it? It's an area of law nobody wants to touch. So something has to crack. But the unions now, from this experience in New York, because we created the mess and we created the control boards, are not in a rush for this. So the day is coming when a municipality cannot make a payroll, and what do you do? Is it New York? Is it California? I'm not sure, but the day is coming. So it's not a happy situation. Nobody has the guts to deal with it. Yes, sir.
Judge, first of all, thank you so much for that talk.
Well, you inspired it today, last night, because I...
All my interests are morbid, and for that reason... what I think is going to come... I mean, I agree with you, the sort of chapter mind stuff. There are, in fact, a few municipalities in other states that went through chapter mind. It doesn't work very well. I mean, it has the same problems, you know, as control boards, except more so because once the bankruptcy process closes, the city is still run by the same thugs. So immediately back to where you came from, and that's right. You can't in the bankruptcy process. It's their business model is failing and flawed, and you can't reorganize them really in a fundamental way in bankruptcy. So that was now. Let me ask you this: what I think is coming is what happened in a lot of other countries that had the same problems. Which is eventually a state or federal takeover of the pension system. Which is, right, it can't happen for cops because they don't have any federal agency to go to. But you can easily imagine the teachers. So the argument is you cannot provide quality schools without teachers, quality teachers, and you can't have quality teachers if they're fearful of not getting their pensions. Right, and the federal law already regulates their entitlements in a million different ways, and so put the entire pension system. There's your bailout.
All right, but the question is, and this is where the unions go nuts: when the pension systems get in trouble and the Fed's taking them over, you come part of that federal what's it called, the
federal benefit guarantee.
That's it.
So what is it?
Yeah, the pension guarantee.
Although that's for private corporations.
I understand, but private corporations, when you get sucked into that, if you were expecting like $40,000 a year, now you're getting like $5,000 a year. The question is, will they maintain the promises in these things? And then there's the issues of constitutional law. In the state of New York, state constitution says whatever you were guaranteed in a pension can never, ever be taken away.
Right.
And, you know, you hit on one other issue, which I didn't touch on either. The unfunded health care. That's the elephant in the room no one is talking about. Now, there are arguments whether or not in New Jersey there's a thought that you could take some of this away. I'm told that E.J. McMahon of the Manhattan Institute runs the Empire Center. He's checkhis.com. He's probably the most knowledgeable fiscal guy on New York. He's just a wonder, Ed McMahon, a very dear friend. He tells me that even on the health care, it's sort of buried somehow in the Constitution that you can't even lose your health care. And so that's an issue that'll be
that's coming. And the municipalities have to do that pay-as-you-go, and it's just going to go through here. Okay? So that's another issue that, I mean, they're either going to have to pay something. I mean, I raised the question of can you tax the state pension? Because right now it's state-free. Now, if you live in the city of New York and you get a 100 grand a year pension, the state income tax is about 7.5%, 8%, whatever the new raise is. So say 8%, city income tax is 3.5%. You're not paying that either. So that, you know, if you do it on what we call the municipal bond as taxable equivalent, it's like getting $115,000 a year because you're not paying state or city tax on your pension. I'm told by E.J. McMahon even that's buried in the Constitution that they can't tax it ever. So I figure that's one way to get revenue. Tax it. Nope, can't tax it. So there's going to be constitutional issues here, which we'll let you think about, noodle down, get more depressed, because if the feds walk in and the teachers say, well, the state constitution says this, what happens? The feds override that? I don't know.
Sure. Right. No, well, the argument would be, you that's the argument for the federal bailout. You can abrogate the state constitution, right, provided the state consents.
That's the price, then.
Right.
That's a trade-off.
Just in federal bankruptcy law. It comes into a federal court.
Because there it cannot be done, and it's been tried. I mean, in the few instances, in the few cities that actually, see, there is a Chapter 9 process for municipal bankruptcy, not for states, but for municipalities, even very large.
Oh, sovereign state cannot go bankrupt. It can,
right,
never go bankrupt.
Oh, that's so, right. Yeah. Right, and but municipalities can.
As a creature of the state.
It works for very small municipalities, say, run a mosquito district. You know, somebody slips on the steps, you have a verdict against you. There's nothing wrong with the mosquito district. They're just illiquid.
Yeah.
So, right, you run them through bankruptcy, screw the attorney who litigated this, and the mosquito district, and the mosquitoes live happily ever after. You cannot do that to a municipality. They'll be back. Orange County went through it, right? The unions took a licking, and 3 years later, the same cast of crooks was back in government, and they made it up to the unions. Did they ever? Right? So, and you cannot, well, and there are all sorts of restrictions. You cannot fire the existing city council or managers. You cannot restructure the local government. You cannot abrogate, in most states, you cannot abrogate the pre-existing contractual conditions. I'm inclined to agree with George that in theory, and on top of it, by the way, you need, for each bankruptcy proceedings, you need the state government's consent, and it will never give it because it loses control.
That's Pennsylvania with the Harrisburg thing. They went into federal courts and was a dumb federal judge in Harrisburg. Because most federal judges in Pennsylvania, it's a corrupt payoff. They all go to jail. But the judge granted the Chapter 9, and they went into an appeal court. The state said, you can't do this. We didn't approve it, and they won. So the state of Pennsylvania, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, would not approve Harrisburg's Chapter 9. They in effect, took over the city by legislative decree a couple of months ago.
And so the control boards are basically, I mean, I think, a better solution. The glitch is, this is the end of local government.
That's it. And they're giving it away. That's the thing. They're handing it over and saying, you guys take care of it. So long as I can be reelected and go play golf with the union guys, I'm a happy guy here and have fundraisers, this and that. That's the problem. It's the end of local government.
Okay, tell me what the political inhibition is on the point of just barring unions. The FDR thought was against collective bargaining. You could argue that the notion of a union in government service is something incompatible with it, because there's a notion of striking against the public service. Should be if it's that necessary, if it has to be run by the public, it shouldn't be open to cessation. You could make that argument, but then look what happened in Ohio. They couldn't get that.
There's always two sets of rules, and they get away with them. You become the majority in the state legislature. The assumption is everyone's going to be there to legislate. Well, they lost, so they went home, and you didn't have a quorum. Now, in New York, you could technically lock up legislators, but I think in Ohio, they jumped over the state line, so they couldn't be tracked. You couldn't subpoena them in the state line, because in New York, you could lock up the legislature. Nelson Rockefeller sent out state troops to get legislators that ran away or afraid to vote for some of his budget years ago, and they just get locked up and dragged into the legislature. But the other issue is the control board that I'm on has seven members. The governor of New York appoints four of them. The speaker of the assembly appoints one. The state comptroller appoints one. And the Senate majority leader. I was nominated by Democratic states. My district was a very Republican-conservative. Guy blew his brain. I was an idiot a couple of terms ago, and a Democrat took it over. It was sort of a Senate Democrat, Craig Johnson. And Craig sat down with me and said, listen, you know, down where you live in that really, it's my area. John McCain carried my area. The guy who ran against, I don't remember his name anymore, against Hillary Clinton in 06 carried my. It's a very old-line conservative, very Catholic. It was a cop and fly in a neighborhood. It's changed dramatically, but still very ethnic, old-line ethnic sort of neighborhoods. So he said, you've got a background in municipal finance. He said, I've been asked, it's my call who this person is going to be the majority leader will appoint. So he said, you know something about municipal finance. You're a conservative. And, you know, I'm a Democrat. It looks like I'm not putting a shill in here because you've got a new Republican county executive and you helped elect him, blah, blah, blah. So we discussed and I said, okay. And actually, I went to see Attorney General Cuomo. And I said, listen, this is when the year he's running for governor. I said, I've been offered this spot by your party. I said, I'm inclined to take it, but I want to let you know, you get elected in November, we could be taking over the county in January. And that's exactly what we did. He was sworn in, and 30 days later, we took over the county. And so I just said, here's, you know who I am, what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do the right thing. So I get the position. It was kept very quiet during the approval, because you got to fill out all the forms and all that shit. This didn't leak. It was amazing. This was the first non-leak I've ever seen. The majority leader, who is now on trial, Pedro Espada, stealing $4 million, whatever, the then majority leader is now out of the Senate. He was very smart, didn't figure out I was the right-wing guy who craps on him in the New York Post all the time. But, yeah, it slipped through. I get the nomination. The teachers' union went nuts. They went nuts for two reasons. Craig Johnson supported charter schools, which don't affect Nassau County at all. It affects an inner city. New York Post endorsed him. The teachers went after him for that and me. And now he's a member of their party. He lost his seat by 400 votes. That turned the Republican Senate into the majority, the Senate into a Republican majority. That seat was the deciding seat.
Amherst,
the
Amherst
union.
Pardon me? Amherst College, class of 93.
Who's that one?
Craig Johnson.
Craig Johnson.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah? All right. Well,
oh, okay.
Craig is now working for Michael Bloomberg News, has a big job there. But anyway, the long and the short is, that turned over the majority to the Republicans. The teachers didn't care. They wanted to punish a guy and send a message saying, we're responsible for him going down. We even gave it to the Republicans. Now, we can control it. We can scare them anyway, so it doesn't really matter. They're a bunch of hookers as well. But they didn't care. They will take you down. They will bus in teachers, do phone banks. They vote 99%. They live in the more middle-class areas. And so that's the battle.
When did collective bargaining begin?
John F. Kennedy.
Kennedy's executive order in 1961.
John F. Kennedy, and then in New York State, it started in the city of New York with Mayor Wagner, and he got it through, I guess, Governor Harriman at the time, and then Rockefeller expanded and
so this is
his history.
Only from the 50s.
That is correct.
After the federal government of 61.
Yeah.
Well, why can't it be undone?
It takes political will. And that's what's lacking. That's why they want control boards. The elected officials, they don't have the political will to do what has to be done. They just want to smile and have fundraisers and to go to ribbon cuttings. They don't want to make decisions in government.
So what if it goes to the national level, a federal amendment, bar these collective bargain unions in the public service? So it's imposed on New York.
Good luck.
Tell me where the political inhibition is in doing this. You say it's a matter of will. Where's the political inhibition?
It is much easier to go along, not have people protesting outside your house, not getting ugly phone calls, death-threatening calls in the middle of the night, not having to fight to death to stay in public life. I don't know why they want them in the first place. They're not willing to govern, but it's a way of life for some of these guys. They're not very smart. They generally don't make it in the private sector. I'm amazed how dumb they are. So you put that all together, they don't want to govern. They just want to do happy things. Ribbon cutting. Hey, we got a new pizzeria. It's open in the neighborhood here. Let's go to ribbon cutting. Everybody's happy. Look at this. Let's have a piece of pizza. Sad to say, Hadley,
yes. Local
government stinks.
Well, this is all the federalist papers, wasn't it?
Yes.
The talent, the rise to
There's a huge point there, it seems to me. I mean, the entire Republican rhetoric is still, you know, local government is closer to the people, therefore they're more virtuous.
Yeah.
And your story and mine is, no, they're all mice training to become rats. Which is, you know.
All right. Any other questions, folks? Yes, sir. Here he is. Here's the man here. All right, now it's going to be the real question. Right?
No. No, to change the subject from something something tragic to something comic, you head of the Port Authority between what years?
I was there in 95, 6, and 7. I had the TWA Flight 800 crash. I was post the 93 bombing. I was pre my success in the 11 went down, 9/11 on the World Trade Center. So I was in between.
Well, let me ask you about security in New York and about the experience that you've had with the TSA and the Port Authority. What has been your experience with them?
Well, TSA didn't exist in my time, but here's how it worked and why TSA is now there, in my judgment. The Port Authority in New York and New Jersey ran the facilities, the three airports, Newark, JFK, and LaGuardia Airport. All right, the busiest airport combined, the busiest in the nation in terms of combined. LaGuardia Airport is geared for short-term domestic runs. LaGuardia, because they have Kennedy, because they have the ability, they got like 5,000 gates, is more international. And then Newark is sort of a mix of local, but because the limited grounds, they don't have the runways that JFK can have because JFK has 5,000 acres. So each serves a purpose in the region, in the New York City region. However, when the security measures began in 1973, when you first got the x-ray machines and all that stuff, the airlines were responsible for that security, their responsibility. They had to pay for it, but worse than that, they were responsible. If there was a glitch going through the bags, and I worked a summit doing those machines, first of all, you know, you're talking to girls, you're talking to cops, you're going this one here. You're right. Anybody who wants to get some through the x-ray machine is going to get it through. It's all based on human beings paying attention, and you can't look at a screen 8 hours a day. You're looking at anything else you want to look at, but it's an imperfect system, far from perfect. And the FAA oversaw it, and then they do testing, you know. Suddenly, you know, they put a bomb in a bag and 14 hand grenades, and you're talking to a girl, and you miss the hand grenades, and they go nuts, and then the airlines get fined and this and that. So they had the responsibility. What the managers of the airports had was a responsibility for the outer grounds. And back in the 70s, 80s, until 9/11, you had four levels of security, one being the best, two, three, four. And the managers, the Port Authority, could raise security levels based on what they're going to hear. Every day I would have a report on my desk in the morning. And keep in mind, we had 35 other facilities. We were working 11 million square feet, the past subway system, blah, 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 blah. Of all the nut bomb threats, nut calls, every day, I'd see the list. At these airports, every day, there was a nut doing something. And you got to make judgment calls. And in certain periods of time, they get worse. If something really happens, even minor, the nuts come out in full force. And then you got real dopes. There was a guy who was trying to get the LaGuardia to catch a plane to Chicago or something, realized he was stuck in traffic on the Grand Central Parkway, pulls out a cell phone, calls in a bomb threat to TWA, or K&M, who the hell was thinking for his flight. Figuring he'll hold up his flight. And he gets... This is a true story. I swear it's a true story. He gets to the gate.
I love that one.
And, you know, you could follow... You know, you watch on NCIS. So, yeah, they could follow these phone calls in 2 seconds. He pulls up to the gate and says, I'm joking. Oh, the flight's delayed. Oh, God, I just made it. And he was just locked up immediately. I mean, he didn't figure out. They could figure out who made this call, for God's sake. At the past subway system, which is a 14-mile system that connects New Jersey and Puerto Rico, you have the PATH headquarters in Jersey City, which is an ugly Stalinist building that was built in the 60s. And you'd have a guy, they caught the guy in the phone booth who would call bomb threats in just because he got a thrill watching the building clear out. And then they figured it out one day a lot, because every day he'd come and call, and then they figured out that's the guy in the phone booth, though. Same guy every day in the phone booth. Right? These are the comical things, but there are nuts out there. During the Flight 800 crash, I moved into JFK Airport. We had nothing to do with the investigation, but we had to take care of 200 family members that came, wanting to know what happened to their loved ones. And it was a three-day screw-up, which is another story for another. It's an amazing story on that Flight 800, because everything that could go wrong and bad happened, and a lot of stupid things and a lot of ugly things. But I was doing this press conference because you had all the international press. Giuliani poked his nose in his mayor because it's not his airport, but he was, yeah, we're all there. And so there was this constant speculation. Was it a bomb? Was it this? Were your security problems, this and that? So it had nothing to do with any of that. It had to do with fumes in a gas tank, and this happens once in a zillion times, and it happened to this flight, say it as it may be. Had nothing to do with the security breach. However, although you're right that the days of hijacking are over and all this stuff is over, the sense of security that people want, I once, during the 50th anniversary of the UN, I was with my wife and some friends, we were lunching in Manhattan at an Indian restaurant by Rockefeller Center. My beepers, phones go off, the Port Authority has its own police department of 1,800 cops. My chief of police saying there's some chatter about something because you had all these sheiks and everybody coming in, and there could be some problems here. So maybe we should increase security. So I was like, because you can go so far and then the FAA has to approve. And then suddenly I'm sitting in this restaurant, the New York City Police Commissioner calls me. Safford, the guy who took over from Bratton Safford. It was pre-Kelly. And he says, the mayor wants to talk. So I'm in a restaurant, like, you know, okay, and you know, I'm calling, talking to Giuliani. He says, we're hearing thus and so. So now I got the mayor thing. The governor is, our governor of New York, George Pataki, loved to vacation. He was vacationing someplace. He spent most of his 12 years as governor vacationing. Christy Whitman was vacationing on the Jersey Shore, so I'm scratching my head. So I talked to my chief of police. I said, let's raise the security level up. Let's go to the top. Four. He says, well, we can't go four, the FAA, and they'll go nuts. So I said, well, can we bring it to 3.9? Yeah, I never thought of that. Well, you figure out what 3.9 is. Well, what happens at that higher level? Here's what happens. Two things. The airlines hate it because they have to increase security to no ends, cost them a ton of money. Two, you have to eliminate, you know, when you get out, you pull up to the TWA building and... Well, let's use somebody's in existence. The American Airlines, well, they're going to bankruptcy too. You pull up American Airlines, you know, you get out of your car, you jump out, you walk in. You have to eliminate all of that people coming up and jumping out of cars in front of the terminus. You have to eliminate at the New York airports 5,000 parking spots because they're too close to the terminals. Okay. So you have to add, then I have to add on all these cops that are grossly overpaid, like Nassau County cops, and you have to have all this additional security. But here's my spot. If nothing goes wrong, they may beat me up for spending all this money. But if something goes wrong and I don't react, then they're going to hang me. So you're stuck. And so the airlines hate me. All this overtime costs $1 zillion. We lose all this revenue from parking and everything else. So the TSA comes into play. Right? If I was still around, I'd be delighted to say to the feds, good luck. And the airlines are saying, it's not, we'll pay for it, but it's not our responsibility. You push the responsibility up another notch. So if something goes
somebody
wrong,
else.
You got it. If something goes wrong, they call Marlon's Port Authority, you know, what happened? The feds are in charge. That's their problem. Give them a buzz here.
It's a piece of the Titanic.
Here's my
responsibility.
The Port Authority cops. Oh, no. 30 of them died in 9/11 in the World Trade Center, but under ordinary circumstances, they, after Nassau County, the second highest paid cops in America, they basically, for the most part, it's a Pinkerton cops job. It's not like being in Manhattan or Brooklyn. My father was a cop in Brooklyn during the riots of the 60s with bad guys are shooting at you. It's a very nice job. They make north of 100 grand a year. And they got a contract that I, too, didn't control the police force. It was controlled by the union. And Al D'Amato and all the boys wouldn't let me touch the unions, went to them because I was taking them on, and suddenly you turn around and you realize you're a one-man band, there's nobody behind you. Al D'Amato, go get them. Unions get to Al, they get to Christy Whitman, they get Pataki, and Marlon sitting there doing the charge all by himself. Example, bomb squads. The Port Authority cops want very badly to be a bomb squad cop. Well, I'm looking at this as the Keystone cops. Although the city of New York has no jurisdiction over the airports, they can only come with my invitation or the executive director's invitation or the manager's invitation. When it came to bomb squads, we called in the city of New York. They handle all bomb squads. They're very good at it. You know, New York City Police Department is a very fine police force. But it became their responsibility. So I had these cops chasing me saying, we want this, and this is going to be a union negotiation. Are you crazy? You Keystone cops? If you're the bomb squad and something happens, that's my fault. Right now, it's their fault, the city of New York, if they're incompetent. So I was not going to change, changed after me, but not during my time. So you're right, responsibility is being pushed around because if you don't react, if you overreact, you might be criticized, but if nothing goes wrong, you move on. If something goes wrong and you didn't overreact, you did. And to push the responsibility to somebody else, the airlines were delighted. Because prior to TSA, they all worked for American Airlines or whomever. They hated it because they caught all the crapola if anything went wrong. So we pushed responsibility up. It's awful. It's done for the most part. You're right. The real stuff is in the bag, kind of detectors, the x-rays that go under. You know, the most important x-ray machine is the ones you don't see, that your baggage goes through. That goes under the train, plane. Sure. You don't know if you're under the plane. That's so you don't know if they've been opened, whatever. But that's the most important part of the security.
Sure.
This is theater for the most part. But the feds wanted it, and then, of course, it became a union issue, as you recall. I think Obama let them unionize, because originally they couldn't be unionized. So now it's a permanent part of the government structure. It's not going to change.
Would you do away with the theater?
I think you could run it down dramatically, okay? But for the sense of security, it's never going to go away.
Right.
Now, listen, the safest airport in the world is in Tel Aviv.
Oh, yeah.
And I had them come over. They showed me all the film. Ronald Lauder, that's the Lauder. You know, Netanyahu's best friend, very wealthy friend of Israel. Vesti Lauder. I had this conversation with him. When you walk into the Tel Aviv airport, you are considered the enemy walking in the door, no matter who you are. Ronald Lauder has to spend 2 hours to get through that airport. It's very funny. So they showed me all the films and everything else, but they, you know, they sit around carrying guns and everything else. It is the safest airport. So do they go to the extreme? Yes, they do. Do they care? They don't care. Takes Ronald Lauder, a billionaire, 3 hours to get through this airport? We don't care. You want to go through our airport? Here's the rules. Now, if they is a lot of that theater, I would guess so. But if they ratchet it down, is something crazy happening? So,
yeah, right.
The politics of it matters. Although, in theory, what you're telling me, you're correct. Most of this is baloney. Going through an old lady's underwear for looking, it's just gets ridiculous, also, because these TSA people are just thick-headed, and common sense doesn't come into play. You know, we're going to examine this 90-year-old woman very carefully, you know, or her grandchild standing there. I mean, come on, all right. But the other fear is racial profiling.
Well, in that regard. Let me point out that in Israel, they don't bother the old lady, and they don't bother you or me, because they do profile, consciously, obviously. And so they will pay absolutely no attention to X, and will pay a great deal of attention to Y, and it is their judgment, and they stand behind their judgment. They're not pushing responsibility away. They take responsibility.
Don't argue it. I get nailed all the time. First of all, I've been people I worked for, but you remember, I downsized it. I was not a very popular guy for an agency, so I think they throw my name in sometimes just so I get stopped. 6'6" white guy, I get stopped all the time. I got to go through the whole drill. All at Washington Airport, never fails. At Reagan Airport, never fails. I walk in, there he is, bang. It's like, all right, I'm here. I surrender. Okay. There is the fear of racial profile. That adds to the ridiculous of the theater. It is what it is, quite frankly. As ridiculous as it is, as costly as it is, it's not going to change.
What's that?
It's not going to change. The airlines are happy it's a Fed problem. Something goes wrong, their problem, go talk to them. And that's what it comes down to.
Well, if we can't have the ice capades, the best show in town is George Marlin. We can have that. Sure, we do have that recorded, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in fact, we have.
They may get subpoenaed for this lawsuit.
We'll have these things recorded. I mean, I've heard some CDs and some.